Welcome to Walking the BJJ Gauntlet, the official podcast of Sydney Jiu-Jitsu Maroubra and Sydney Jiu-Jitsu Zealand. My name is Derek Riley, and my game is to use the curiosity of the beginner to prize various truths and insights from our interview subjects. Today's guest is a surfer, war crimes investigator, and author of Law and War, a book about the Nuremberg Trials, facing death in Cambodia, its topic of the Cambodian genocide, and what we're going to be hitting today, Breathe, the newish bio on Jiu-Jitsu icon Hixson Gracie. Now, if you love jiu-jitsu, you'll know Hixson, son of Elio Gracie, undefeated across his 40 years of jiu-jitsu and MMA, a 450-0 record. He was the king of Vale Chudo in Japan, earning $1 million or thereabouts a fight. Peter Maguire, meanwhile, came to jiu-jitsu as a black belt in Jeet Kune Do. And in the early 90s, he strolled into Hixson's wildly notorious Pico Boulevard gym in Los Angeles, and life sure did take a turn. Man, some of the stories. Ooh-wee.
Peter, let's establish your jiu-jitsu bona fides. Where did you start and how did it all lead to Hixson?
I was training with the great John Peretti in New York City, the founder of Extreme Fighting, and then went on to become the matchmaker of the UFC until it was sold to the Zuffas. And he was a world champion kickboxer and a truly dangerous man. And then I went to Hixson's Pico Academy the first time in the summer, I think of 92, and got a private from Hixson and was a, you know, pretty accomplished stand-up fighter, kickboxer, Jeet Kune Do, and the Gracies and the ground fighting really scared me. And so we became friends and then I would go back in the summers, and then summer of 93 was a big summer and I trained there regularly. And then at the end of that summer, Hoist came in to train with Hixson for the first UFC, which was in the fall of 93. And it was kind of like a cougar training a kitten.
So talk me through that first private lesson you had with Hixson in 92.
You know, he's a really generous teacher. He's a real, he's a real teacher, Hixson Gracie. And he knew my background and you know, the way he teaches is that the first lesson is kind of to hook you. It's not to beat you up or anything like that. It's to enamor you with this amazing thing of jiu-jitsu. And he certainly did that. And a great wrestler named Todd Irvin was the one who brought me in there, who was, I think a Division I college wrestler. And so Todd had said, man, this is another level. And back then it was the Garcia brothers. That's what we had heard of, the Garcia brothers, these Mexicans. Yeah, these Mexican wrestlers, the Garcia brothers. So that was the rumor. And then we find out they're Brazilians and they surf. And then we all surf. And so it was an easy, it was an easy fit. And yeah, as I said, Hixson was a very generous teacher. And at one point he said, oh yeah, here, fight me standing up. And I fought him and I'm there and I have my good hands and everything. And then he just like pimp slaps me and spins me in a 360. And I spin in a 360 with my hands still up. And he says, oh, your hands, they work very nice, but you're weak. And so that's when he began to teach me about connection and, you know, these very deep principles that is kind of where he is right now. Connection, timing, patience, big issues. And then over the years, as I said, we were good friends and still are, because we didn't relate on jiu-jitsu or whatever else. I was never really a sycophant. I had done a lot and I was then, working in real life, you know, situations. And I would come back to them and say, hey, you know, I got attacked on a motorcycle by three guys. I got this, like, you know, real world stuff. And he would sit there and kind of pause and go, And he would think it through. No, you can't go to the ground. You can never go on your back in that situation. And so he was very realistic and you know, met multiple colleagues of mine over the years, and was always just a kind of sage, you know, advisor and good friend. And then, you know, Henzo came to New York City after I had been training with Craig Kukoc, who was his original partner. And then that was much later, you know, that was a couple of years later. And then I remember John Donner's first night, you know, in that world. And
can you describe John's first night?
I don't know if it was the first night. It was probably the first week. And, you know, he was in his famous New York Giants jersey, I think, and nylon shorts and whatnot, big hulking guy. And, you know, was really captivated by it because he was a Kiwi. He was a bouncer. He was studying philosophy at Columbia at the time, where at that time I was a professor. And he really was just captivated by it. And he never left. Like, he walked in that Henzo Gracie Academy, he never left. And he abandoned academia wisely. I probably should have. And you know, just really was a cerebral guy and a physical guy. And he was able to kind of pull it apart and quantify it in a way few others ever have been able to. And I think that's John's genius. But yeah, he was just absolutely dedicated from day one and you know, put in the hard yards. Where I didn't. I mean, I did and I didn't. I was surfing a lot. I was living on the North Shore. I was in Cambodia. And once the open guard game started and the spider guard, everybody started getting horrible knee injuries. And that kind of scared me a bit. And that was the beginning of the modern jiu-jitsu stuff. And I kind of liked the Hickson stay on top, beat him fucking to death with elbows and headbutts. And that was the game that was the one I liked. So
talk about the, you know, go back to the Pico Boulevard gym. It was a pretty rough joint in the early 90s, right?
Yeah, it was. Everybody in there was a serious martial artist. Lots of, you know, great black belts and different styles. I mean, Paul Vunak was in there, John Lewis, and just really distinguished people. But the guys who used physical force in their daily occupations were the scariest guys. So you had monster Navy SEALs. You had, I think the scariest guy in there I ever came up against was probably like a 300-pound oil rig, like the guy who like puts the pipes together on an oil rig. And he was so slow and big, but he would just get you in his guard and just grab an arm and just fucking peel it away. And there was nothing you can do. So there were the prison cell extraction unit guys, who were the ones who would put body armor and like go in the maximum security prison and get the troublesome guys and deal with them. So there were just some serious guys in there that, like I said, physical force was their daily bread. And they weren't there to learn, you know, the De La Hiva guard or whatever else. They were there, you know, and with great respect. And it was an interesting place. It was very respectful time. And that was, you know, is a thing that's bothersome to me about the UFC and all that. Was back then, and then the first UFC and Extreme Fighting and Pride and all that. Everybody was very cool with each other because you would always wind up training with each other. There was no, you could talk your bullshit and all that, but you would all wind up in the same gym at some point. And so this WWF era was problematic to me because that was never part of the original culture. It was always very respectful. Okay, you're going to fight this guy, you're going to fight that guy. That's fine. I can't train you for that fight because you're fighting my cousin or my friend or whatever. But at the end of the day, you guys fight and we'll all come back. We'll all train together. But since, you know, as I said, this UFC thing of WWF and the trash talking and the nonsense, that was never a part of the culture.
And did Hickson play a big part in that, you know, respect culture?
Well, you had no choice. I mean, you know, you had no choice. I mean, he would line the whole class up against the wall and beat everybody in there, period. He'd just say, okay, today, everybody against the wall. Okay, you, come on, one after the other, boop, boop, boop. 30 guys, tap them all out. Some guys take 30 seconds. Some guys take 2 minutes. But so, you know, it was a true hierarchy. It was a very honest culture. And that's what I think attracted a lot of us. And talk about multiculturalism and this kind of stuff. Everybody was there. And it didn't matter. You were white, black, gay, straight, whatever. You fucking got in there and earned your stripes or you didn't. And there was no, no calling the dean or saying, oh, geez, you know, he wasn't nice to me or whatever. No, it was great. It was, and I think a lot of us at that point were searching for it. I know Donna and I were. We were kind of going into academia. I was in academia. Donna was looking at academia and looking at me going like, God, this is fucking, this is bad, you know? And I'll never forget Donna and Enzo coming to a class of mine at Columbia. And I'm talking about the samurais and this and that. And I have some, pre-Cambian woke student at the very, very beginning of the woke period say like, oh, Professor McGuire, I don't think it's constructive for you to talk in such general terms about the Japanese warrior culture. You know, they had a lot of democracy in the post-World War I era. And I was like, well, they had about 1,000 years of feudalism before that. But anyway, I think, honestly, I remember John just rolling his eyes and realizing, no, there's no place for us in this world. And so he was quicker to realize it than I was.
So for anyone who hasn't read the book or who isn't totally au fait with the Hickson Gracie legend, can you give us a little rundown? And I guess start with his genesis, because he was an early example of genetic modification, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was, you couldn't make up the Gracie family lineage. And it was, you know, really, there were multiple brothers, but the two key brothers were Carlos and Elio Gracie, and they had many sons from many women in an effort to create a clan of warriors and the Scottish Brazilians. And they did. And, they were all taught jiu-jitsu from the cradle, and some were better, some were worse. And, they were raised by wolves, and Hickson was, the king of the litter, and from a very early age, and exceptional, you know, in competitive jiu-jitsu, and then MMA, or much more than MMA, Vale Tudo, which is what we were trained in, which was to fight no gloves, no headbutts, groin strikes, eye gouging, 20-minute rounds. And that was the culture we grew up in. That was the culture he passed on to us, was be prepared to fight a 350-pound guy, 10 times your strength, that's, you know, trying to bite your face. And so it wasn't anything like today's MMA. And so, you know, that's what Hickson grew up in. He has his first big MMA fight, or Paulo Tudo fight, at 19 against the famous Ray Zulu, King Zulu, guy who outweighs him by 60 pounds or something, terrifying guy, and panics a bit and ends up beating him, but, you know, comes undone psychologically. And that's Hickson's kind of moment of satori, where he then begins to seek out other teachers beyond jiu-jitsu. How can I begin to deal with psychological collapse, as not necessarily physical or that, but how do I deal with, you know, this kind of unknown realm? And that's where he turns to a guy named Orlando Cani, who's Brazil's greatest modern pentathlon athlete, a world champion, and a very interesting guy who goes on to study with Sri Yoganda in India in yoga, and then establishes a kind of martial arts or yoga practice called Biogymnastica. And he becomes, in a funny way, Hickson's most important teacher. And you know, like Hickson, he's an unparalleled champion athlete. And he basically says, Hickson, all great athletes fail. Failure is part of it. What is important is how you recover from failure. And so that then kind of becomes, you know, Hickson's mantra. And it's all about, you know, being intuitive and the ability to recover from failure. So,
but apart from being, I guess, pushed to his limit with that, you know, early fight with Zulu, he never failed.
No. Well, he, his final fight with Funaki, I mean, he has his ultimate test where, you know, the Japanese get smart. Funaki's one of the great Japanese MMA fighters. And the Japanese didn't want Hickson to fight a white guy or a Brazilian. They wanted a Japanese guy to knock him off. And so they brought their pro wrestlers, but the pro wrestlers weren't up to the job. So finally they brought Funaki, and then, you know, Funaki, they're in a kind of clinch. They fall to the ground. Funaki elbows him and breaks Hickson's orbital bone. So Hickson loses his vision. And so he's on his back with Funaki kicking him and basically can't see. And it's funny because when he described it to me, he said, I wasn't that worried. I thought, this is my ultimate test. Like, this is what I've been training for. And I can beat him without vision. And he's not going for the kill, which was the kind of ultimate sign for Hickson. Like, no, he's not going for the kill. He has his kill moment right now, and he's not seizing it. So I'm okay. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to let him kick my legs. Big deal. And then his vision started to come back, and he only saw like 6 Funakis in one eye and 20 Funakis in the other eye. And then he was like, okay, this is fucking easy day. And then he kicked Funaki in the knee and busted his knee, and then got up, took him down, and you know, beat him like a fucking red-haired stepchild.
So why wasn't Hickson the face of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu at the UFC? Because that was created by Jorge and Gracie and John Milius.
Yeah, it was political, you know. The official reason is that Hoist, the skinny undistinguished, competitively younger brother, if he could beat all these monsters, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the truth was that Hickson was threatening to Horion, and Hoist was more manageable. And that's my subjective opinion. But I was there and I watched Hickson train Hoist. And, you know, the official story is, oh, we're going to save Hickson in the background so that if any problem happens with Hoist, we'll bring Hickson in as the closer. But, you know, Hoist became a fucking superstar and he, you know, he was the most dangerous man alive, according to, you know, public opinion at that time, where people didn't know anything about anything. And, you know, he, I think, made it to UFC 3 without a problem and you know, did a great job, given that, you know, Henzo was a very distinguished fighter at that point and had fought a ton of MMA. And there were a lot of Gracies, even Hoyler. So Hoist was a gamble, you know, because he was not MMA champion or a great, you know, Mundial Jiu-Jitsu champion. And the fact that he was able to beat all these monsters was very significant and helped sell the brand and everything else.
Have you seen Hoist and Hickson roll?
Yeah, way back when.
Yeah.
There's no, it was, the last time I saw them roll, really the only time I saw them roll, was in the summer of 93 when Hickson was getting Hoist ready for the UFC and he would torture him nicely for better part of an hour. And then you pat him on the head and kiss him on the cheek and say, great job, you're ready, you know? And so they're not in the same league, period. Yep. Hickson, anyone will tell you that. I mean, Paulo Filho, you know, Bustamante, everybody will say that, you know, Hickson was in his own league. And he really was. And, you know, like him, hate him, say, oh, he dodged the best guys. Oh, he this, he that. He doctored his record, whatever. Ask anybody who got on the mat with him way back when. Jocko Willing, anybody. And they'll say, like, yeah, it was fucked up.
So how did your friendship with Hickson lead to the book?
Oh, we talked about it for years and years and years, and I kept diaries and notes. I always kept martial arts diaries from the Peretti days, because I think that's important for listeners, is to really keep journals and notes, because there will be tiny little eureka moments where you're like, oh, fuck, that's all, ooh, just trap the arm and block the foot and get your head out of the way and bridge up instead of flop over to the side, which most people don't do right, right? The bridge and roll escape from mount is like, I can't emphasize that enough. There's just these building blocks. And so, you know, I was careful to write all this stuff down, and I kept all this stuff for all these years. And we had talked about it back and forth for a long time. And then, you know, COVID hit and we said, okay, let's do it.
So how did the process work? So you interview Hickson and then you write it first person, as in his voice. Were you in the same city? Were you, how did you do it?
Yeah, no, I go and I spend usually like a week and go see him 2 to 3 hours a day. And we meet on the mats and train and talk. And then I transcribe it and I take my voice out. And then we did a lot of follow-up on the phone for, you know, holes in the narrative and stuff like that. But he's, you know, he knows what he wants to say. And the second book we're doing now is interesting because he's probably even more fired up about this book than the first book. And to be honest, I was like, oh, second book, okay. You know, it was a huge bestseller. It's published now in, I think, 10 languages or something. And I thought, okay, you know, I thought he kind of had everything he had to say, but no, he's really obsessed with teaching a kind of simple jiu-jitsu to total civilians, non-fighters, non-tough guys. And his thing now, as he's getting older, as his body's starting to break down, is that the people that need jiu-jitsu are not the people I've spent my whole life teaching. They're the weak, they're the vulnerable, they're the old, they're the threatened. And so it's an interesting, it'll be an interesting book. And he's very inspired by this. And it's funny, I brought our editor, who was a key guy in getting the book done. We got that book done in 6 months. And I had a great, you know, great editor, Peter Dimmick in New York City. But then I had a great sub-editor named Henrik Jaranowski, who was about 5'7", 220, not necessarily in the greatest shape. And I said, Hickson, you know, we have like student zero with the editor that got our book done on time. There's no way around it. We owe it to him. So he came out with me the last trip to Hickson, and he did the whole invisible jiu-jitsu curriculum with Hickson. And, you know, this is a seriously cerebral guy, Princeton summa cum laude, Yale Law School. You know, his brain is his weapon, not his fists. And he called it a life-changing experience. And yeah, it was remarkable.
So is the book called Invisible Jiu-Jitsu?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
And is it going to be an instructional book? Or is it going to be a series of philosophies?
No, it's going to be a long kind of philosophical essay. And then there will be some instructional stuff, but it's not at all like grab his left wrist, move your thigh to his thing. No, it's much more conceptual than that. And, you know, it's kind of like, what is invisible jiu-jitsu? It is, you know, it's kind of, it gives anyone a fighting chance. And maybe that fighting chance is to run away. Maybe that fighting chance is just to recognize a threat or see, I better cross the street, you know? And that's what's interesting. So it's geared to that kind of person. It's not geared to Billy Badass, you know. And he would say to, you know, he said to Henry, he's like, hey, Henry, you will never be as Kieker, but you might survive. And so that was what, you know, that's where he is right now.
It's like a real world jiu-jitsu self-defense kind of angle.
Yeah. And recognizing threats and seeing them before they see you. And, you know, just the way the real world is, you know, it's not, you're not pulling a guy to the ground and taking him in the guard and heel hooking him, you know, in Compton, you know, unless you want a boot party.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way. You know? I had a situation in downtown LA and, you know, and it was fine. And I kind of de-escalated it as you could say, but it wasn't a big deal. But I spotted the threat and I sensed the predator, and the predator moved and I intercepted the predator. And he brought his hands up, and I brought my hands up, and I did jazz hands to him, and I smiled at him. And it really unnerved him. And then he smiled, laughed, and wanted to fist bump with me and wanted to be my new best friend. And a lot of times that's all it is, you know? It's like they want the easy prey, you know, the predator. They don't want, once you kind of, you know, intercept or are proactive, not only is it not fun, it's just wrong party. Oh, let's find an easier one, you know? And so, yeah.
Wow. So something that I found very interesting in Breathe was the history of jiu-jitsu, you know, obviously the Scottish Gracies.
Yeah.
But Hideo Maeda,
Yeah.
He's so important, but I haven't heard of him. Can you talk about his?
Remarkable guy. I mean, the Hideo Maeda is the most interesting guy in the whole puzzle. And, you know, I'm doing a film with Jose Padilla from Narcos, and we had been dealing with one of the big companies that are now in some stock trouble. I won't name them. But they said, oh, this Japanese guy, you got to get rid of him. Oh, this isn't interesting. It all needs to be about the Gracies. And we were like, oh, my God, you got to be kidding. And Hideo Maeda is a remarkable guy, and he is – you know, one of the best judo players in the world at the Kodokan with Jigoro Kano, the founder of jiu-jitsu, the inventor of jiu-jitsu. But then he's kind of a wild guy, and he gets in trouble for prize fighting and this and that, kind of runs afoul of Kano. Then comes to the United States like pre-World War I, and then goes to funny places where I taught. Columbia University, West Point, and takes on all comers. And then his teacher is with him, and he sort of gets humiliated by the wrestling coach at West Point. He goes back to Japan. Maeda stays in the U.S. and then prize fights in Brooklyn, in North Carolina, all over the place. And back then, they had like was called like catch as catch can wrestling, and you would go to a fair and you would say, okay, all comers, we got Mr. Japanese tough guy, who wants to take him? So Maeda did that, and he smashed everybody. Then Maeda went to Europe and fought the British boxers. Then he went to France, Germany, and pretty much beat everybody. Then he wound up in Cuba, when it was like wild gambling times and all that, and smashed everybody. Then nobody really wanted to fight him, so he invented the wrestling mask. So Maeda is the guy who invents the fucking Mexican wrestling. And then Maeda goes to Mexico and fights. And then he goes on a tour of South America and in a roundabout way, winds up in Belém, Brazil, and Amazonia, and meets Hickson's, would be his,
great uncle?
No, I think it'd be his grandfather. It was his grandfather. And, he's kind of a hustler who sells dynamite and is a fight promoter in Amazonia, which is a wild place. Yeah, so Maeda winds up in Brazil after fighting all over South America and is kind of lured into setting up a school in Belém by Hickson's grandfather, Gastão. And then he trains not only Carlos Gracie, and what was George, the red cat, the most interesting guy who was kind of a foul of Hideo and Carlos because he liked to drink and womanize. Yeah, the red cat. I like him. And he was fighting motherfucker, George. And so and they taught some other guys as well. So there's some other descendants of Maeda in Brazil that deserve great credit. You know, it's not a simple narrative. And then Gastão runs out of money. He's always kind of hustling, things going good, things going bad. He also had multiple families and baby mamas and things like that. So it's not, apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And then, you know, Carlos, Elio, and George, and then there's, I think, Gustav Jr. or something, they moved to Rio, and they set up an academy, and they lay down the Gracie Challenge. Anybody can come, any way, anytime, anything, we'll fight you. And they do, and they do well.
Wow. And yeah. So how does the Brazilian version of Maeda's Jiu-Jitsu differ from Maeda's Jiu-Jitsu? What changed? What adapted?
I think that a huge part of it was Helio, because he was very small. And I think he really was the master of the guard. And so I think Helio was the one who took the guard to new places. And then I think Rolls Gracie, or Holes Gracie, Hickson's older brother who died, becomes the one who really takes that guard to a new, more offensive, aggressive place. And I think that's what's kind of interesting about Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, is that a lot of it is open to interpretation and modification. And they're not altogether against that. Like even Donaher invented things. You have people, you go, wow, I know this from wrestling. I know that. And they go, wow, that's kind of interesting. Here, show it to me. Let me see if it works. So you have a lot of people adding to the system. And I think Rolls, or Holes Gracie, was a really important innovator who studied wrestling, judo, very open-minded guy. And I think the same with Hickson. I think Hickson, you know, he, in a funny way, Hickson's jiu-jitsu is very simple. And, you know, and it's kind of the way I teach, but it's, you know, anytime anyone tries to teach me, like, grab the left sleeve, get the elbow, move your hip 40 degrees to the right, then bring, and I'm like, dude, I'm making a cup of coffee by the time you're fucking halfway through that move. Like, it doesn't work that way. And so I think things like base, connection, timing, patience are the more profound principles, especially today, with the two big ones to me are patience and timing. And the biggest thing, in my opinion, that's fucked up jiu-jitsu is the clock on the wall and the sport jiu-jitsu time frame. So I have these great blue belts that I train that are monsters, great athletes, and they come every Sunday. They're all 200-pound champion athletes, but they train at a great academy, but their head coach is a wrestler, and wrestling's all about time. And it took me a while, and I would say, okay, go, bam, like that. And I was like, you guys look like monkeys trying to fuck a basketball. Like, what are you doing? And, you know, we only have 3 minutes. We only have 3 minutes on the wall. And I said, Jesus. And so I think the haste isn't part of jiu-jitsu, and it never was. But, you know, now with sports jiu-jitsu, now with a lot of wrestlers getting involved, wrestlers can't be passive. Wrestlers have to be aggressive. They have to take the game to the other guy, whatever else. And that's not, in my opinion, jiu-jitsu. And so it's, you know, I've had to like downshift these guys, and I'll say, okay, go ahead. You here, mount. And they'll mount. And I won't do anything for a minute, nothing. And they'll do this, do that, try to choke me, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll grab my two fingers and I'll take their sleeve. And they won't even know it. They'll just pull their sleeve a little across my chest. They still don't know it. And then I'll pull my feet really close to my butt. And then I'll grab their elbow, whoop, oopa, and proper oopa, straight up, not to the side. And then they're on their back, and I pass their guard. And I was like, okay, so that was, I'm old, I'm 57, okay? And then, you know, and then they start to see it, you know. But again, patience and timing. Timing is so key. And, you know, like I get, I'll feed guys, I'll put a guy in a bad triangle, and I'll know that he's going to not come straight into me and put my knee in my face as he should, right? He's going to try to go out the window. And it'll be a shitty triangle. But then when he goes out the window to the side, boom, I get the good triangle and I slap it on him. And it's, again, it's like, it's patience and timing. It's like one shot, one kill. And that's the way you have to look at jiu-jitsu. And when I was, you know, younger, I was small. So I was going against monsters and I would usually only get one opportunity. I wouldn't be on top. I'd be just on the bottom getting, you know, surviving. And then if I got half guard on the top, I was a happy day, you know? So,
so if we can take anything away from Breathe, it'd be timing and patience.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think timing, patience, and simplicity. And I think, again, you know, it's like really good writing. You know, look at Orwell, simple, not easy. And I think that, and Bruce Lee said that, simple, not easy. And, you know, and you look at great boxers sometimes only have like one or two good punches, but they do them so well that even if you know they're coming, you can't defend against them. And so that's the thing with jiu-jitsu. I mean, you really want your real fundamentals to be really good. And to get caught up in the sleeve grabbing and the lassoing and all this stuff. I let guys do that. I'm like, I don't even know what the fuck you're doing. And then I kind of go, oh, okay, all right. Kind of have an arm a little bit and stuff, but doesn't work so good when I put my knee on your neck. And so, yeah, it's, you know, but I mean, we play a brutal game here at Firebase McGuire. And Derek, I hope you come to visit soon. Yeah. With the Wolverine.
I would love to come. Was that the Wolverine before?
Horrifying. Yeah.